This podcast of The Exchange is sponsored by Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And the Dagoba Group, a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice with specialties in unconscious bias, leadership dynamics, and client engagement. Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend. More at thedagobagroup.com.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, equal housing opportunity.
Support for The Exchange Friday New Hampshire News Roundup is made possible by Eastern Bank. We're here, you're first.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Canoy, and this is The Exchange. It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. As concern over the war in Syria rises, it's echoing in our presidential primary. Speaking in Keene, Republican candidate Donald Trump seemed to reverse his earlier position that some Syrian refugees should be allowed in for humanitarian reasons.
I'm putting the people on notice that are coming here from Syria that if I win, they're going back. They're going back. I'm telling you, they're going back.
Meanwhile, another Republican contender, Ben Carson, spent time in the state. Carson spoke in Exeter, saying while he is a political outsider, his background's broad enough to tackle the presidency.
So, believe me, I do have economic experience. And those people who say he's a doctor, he's a neurosurgeon, he only knows that, he's an idiot savant, they are the idiots.
Also this week, the governor and state officials unveiled a new broad-based campaign aimed at the opioid addiction crisis. Here's Health and Human Services Commissioner Nick Tumpas.
Each one of us can play a role in fighting this devastating disease that needs no more stigma, no more shame, no more denial, no more fear, but demands our best effort and our deepest compassion.
It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup today in The Exchange, and let's hear from you. Call in. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Our guests for this week's roundup are Paul Steinhauser, political director and anchor for NH1 News. Paul, welcome back. Good to see you.
Oh, thank you, Laura. Great to be here.
Also with us, Gary Reno, Statehouse reporter for the New Hampshire Union Leader and Sunday News. And Gary, thanks for your time.
Oh, great to be here, Laura.
Also with us, Dean Spiliota, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. And Dean, thank you as always.
Good morning, Laura.
Well, I want to start off with a very serious topic. And Dean, I'll turn to you first. Lots of activity this week concerning what's often referred to in shorthand as the opioid addiction crisis. Couple news items this week on this, Dean.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is something we've been talking about, unfortunately, very regularly on the roundup. We've seen a significant spike in overdose fatalities in recent years. It keeps climbing each year. The issue is heroin use and also prescription opioids. So a couple of things going on this week. The State Attorney General, Joe Foster, has announced an investigation into whether or not drug makers are playing down the risks of opioid addiction while overstating the benefits of treatment. So essentially kind of a fraudulent marketing. And this is something that's been undertaken in a number of different states, admittedly with mixed results. It hasn't always kind of worked out in favor of the punishing companies for deceptive advertising. But New Hampshire's undertaking it nonetheless, and Foster has said it's going to take a while to kind of compile the record necessary for the investigation. And then kind of one of the other big stories was that the state purchased 5,000 kits. These are Narcan kits, the naloxone, which is the sort of antidote to an overdose that can save someone's life. They had a $500,000 federal grant. They bought 5,000 kits for community health centers and for families of people who are at risk. And I think also now we have the ability of doctors to write prescriptions for Narcan for families with people who are at risk.
So just first responders.
First responders, families. You have these kits that will be free, and then, of course, the investigation. So, yeah, this has been this has sort of been a big issue here in New Hampshire now for some time, and a lot of political debate, too, we can talk about how it's being handled.
Sure. Well, and Gary, there was also another sort of big conference unveiling another effort, and you did hear some frustration by some at that event saying, okay, enough sitting at round tables and drinking coffee. Right. Well, you know, let's do this.
Let's do something about it. I mean, let's take some concrete action. And I mean, obviously, the Narcan distribution is concrete action. I mean, it's sort of like, if you will, a Kickstarter campaign. They're trying to get this drug out into the community. And as Dean was talking about, it's, these families, it's available to these families, but these families, it's been that way. The law passed, I think, in May and was signed in May. And these families are saying, we can't find it. We can't find it. How do we get it? And so this was sort of like a Kickstarter. We're going to throw this, we're going to put these 5,000 kits out there. We're going to give them the community health centers. We're going to have these events. And then we're going to keep going and going and trying to get it down into the people who need it. And then hopefully as that goes forward, then the doctors can kick in with these what they call standing orders, which means that you can place this with a pharmacy and you can go get it whenever you want to.
Wow.
Then I hope that will really have an effect and really stop some of this overdosing that's going on.
Well, and this has become an issue in the presidential campaign. Lots of candidates talking about this, and we'll talk about that a little bit later in the show. But Paul Steinhauser, it's also become an issue in the race for New Hampshire governor.
It has. We had Chris Sununu, the executive counselor, and the first candidate actually to announce for governor. And he was very critical of the governor. He's a Republican, obviously, on the executive council and the son of a former governor. He was very critical of the governor, saying that she and her drug czar had basically been non-existent on the issue. And we spoke to the governor yesterday to give her a chance to respond, and she definitely pushed back, listing about a bunch of things she's done just in the last week, some of the stuff that Dean and Gary have been talking about, and she recommended that Chris Sununu watch TV news to see what she's doing.
Well, let's hear what Chris Sununu said in his interview with you, Paul.
The governor and her drug czar have been absolutely non-existent on one of the most important crises this state has ever faced, and it's shameful. And I've been very, very vocal about that because I think people need to know what is going on. And what is going on is nothing.
Okay, so Paul Steinhauser, what is going on is nothing. Governor Hassan probably said, let's not exaggerate.
She definitely didn't agree with that. She has been active. But Sununu also, you know, to his credit, he pointed out and he talked about four or five things he would do immediately on day one as governor that is different than what this governor is doing. But listen, it is a top issue in the gubernatorial race. It's going to be a big issue in Senator Ayotte's reelection next year. And it is a big issue on the presidential campaign trail here in New Hampshire.
All right. Again, the number for you to join the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup, 1-800-892-6477. Join us as we wrap up some of the top New Hampshire news stories of the week. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Gary Reno, a quick question for you since you're our State House reporter. Out of the State House this week, there was news that the state has a surplus.
A rather large surplus, a $73 million surplus, which was kind of surprising to everybody. I mean, when they did the budget, they expected surplus of about $60 million. And they put some of the money in the rainy day fund and carried over about $50 million into this biennium's budget. But nobody was really expecting $73 million, largely due to what they call lapses, which is money that you tell state agencies, here's your budget, but you have to save 3.whatever% and return it. And that way we can use the money for other stuff. One of the largest lapses was at the Department of Health and Human Services.
Sure, since that's the biggest department.
But, I mean, it was like $41 million out of the $81 million in lapses. We've already heard about the developmentally disabled lapse, which was $14 million. And people are kind of saying, well, where's this money? Why do we have all this money sitting around when we have all these people that are on the wait list.
It's kind of shocking, Gary. I mean, the words money sitting around and state budget aren't usually used in the same sentence.
Not in New Hampshire. No.
So what happens next with this $73 million?
Well, the governor, when she announced it, she came out and said, well, I think maybe we ought to be talking about looking at giving additional money to local school districts because we're having that whole issue with the fast-growing school districts that haven't been getting what they deserve under the formula, and then we're trying to ratchet down some of what we give all communities, which of course hurts the ones who the poorer communities more than it hurts the ones who are on the upper end of the property rich scale. So that's her suggestion. I'm sure there'll be other suggestions as we go forward. All this money has also fueled a little chatter about a special session coming up for any number of things you hear. You hear the opioid crisis, you hear net metering, and now you're hearing this thing about education. But I don't think we're going to be seeing any special sessions between now and January.
Dean, how do you interpret this after all the back and forth we had on business tax cuts and we can't afford them, and then all of a sudden there's $73 million sitting around?
Yeah, you never know until you actually know what you have. And as Gary mentioned, there was some criticism at some of that money that was left on the table at Health and Human Services. And it was interesting to me to think about the kind of recent debate over the state budget. And, you know, one of the reasons why Republicans wanted to, you know, kind of were comfortable putting off settling until the fall was to see what kind of surplus we're going to have. And they've already gone ahead and reached a deal on that. So, you know, fiscal circumstances can change quickly, more money than we thought there would be. But as Gary said, I don't know necessarily that anything additionally in terms of a policy is going to come from it.
All right. Again, the number for you to join us here on the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup as we catch up on some of the big news of the week, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter as well, 1-800-892-6477. And gentlemen, let's go to the phones. Wolf's calling from Exeter. Hi, Wolf. You're on the Friday News Roundup on New Hampshire Public Radio. Go ahead.
Hi. Hillary and Maggie have their big thing about this heroin thing and all of the OxyContin pills and all of that and everything. But Maggie and our government was supposed to put 5% of the profits from liquor stores into treatment programs for alcoholics. They've never put a penny into it.
This is the, you know, the liquor fund,
This is a problem that was there way before these pills. And these drug companies shouldn't be pushing these pills anyway.
You know, Walt, sorry to cut you off there, Walt, but Gary did want you to jump in to just explain for the broader audience the important point that Walt is making. He's right. There's a fund that is supposed to go to alcohol and drug abuse.
Right. It was established by then-Senator Ned Gordon, who's now a district court judge, and it was about 15 years ago probably. The first year, it actually had money in it. After that, it never had any money in it to this year. They probably put some money in this year, but when they did that, they lowered the percentage down to, I think, 2% instead of 5%.
Okay, well, thanks for the call. And, you know, Paul, he also mentioned Maggie Hassan. He also mentioned Hillary Clinton. Now, how much has this opioid crisis been on Mrs. Clinton's agenda?
A lot. In fact, her first visit up here as a declared candidate was in April. She went to Keene and did a business roundtable of a small business out there, and it came up, and it came up a couple times. And it's come up ever since, and she's talked about it a lot. In fact, just 2 weeks ago when she was in Laconia, she put out a plan. She said she was going to do this. She was going to talk to a lot of experts, and she put out a plan of what she would do as president. So it has been a big part of her campaign, and not just her. Some of the others as well. Chris Christie has talked about it a lot, Governor Christie, and what he's done in New Jersey. Jeb Bush just this week talking, getting very personal at a roundtable about this in Manchester, talking about his own daughter who had substance abuse issues back when he was governor of Florida. She spent some time in jail even and in rehab. So it has come up a lot with the candidates. It has been an issue here more so than in Iowa or South Carolina, where the candidates also spend a lot of time.
Interesting. Well, Wolf, thank you very much for the call. Gary, do you want to jump back in?
Yeah, I did. I mean, I think this week, too, we have a little bit of the our deja vu all over again in honor of Yogi Berra. But where the primary is under attack from the head of the Republican National Committee. I mean, this is the beauty of the New Hampshire primary. Here is an issue that wasn't an issue on the national level. They came here to New Hampshire. They met with people. They saw the problems, and they heard people's concerns. And now it's become a national issue because of that.
Yeah, well, and we'll talk a little bit later about that latest rumbling on the First in the Nation front. Since you mentioned Chris Christie, Paul, I did want to let folks hear a little bit from New Jersey Governor Chris Christie. He was at the We Believe in Recovery rally at White Park in Concord last weekend, talking about the fact that he's been working on this issue in New Jersey. Let's hear.
We're the first state in the country who says that if you're a first-time drug offender, nonviolent, you don't go to jail. You go to mandatory inpatient drug rehabilitation, and we should do that all over the country.
Again, that's New Jersey Governor Chris Christie running for president here in New Hampshire, talking about the heroin and opioid addiction crisis as it relates to his campaign and his plans if he were to win the presidency. Again, the exchange number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange at nhpr.org. Dean, I did want to switch gears for a moment and ask you about another development in New Hampshire's only death row case. Michael Addison, convicted of killing police officer Michael Briggs a number of years back now, still sitting on death row. What's the latest in this case, please, Dean?
Yeah, it's amazing to read that it was actually 2006. It was nine years ago was the shooting of Officer Briggs. Addison's lawyer has filed an argument saying that the death penalty in the state is unconstitutional, dealing with sort of the application. I guess the state law requires you either use death by hanging or a very specific mix of drugs for lethal injection, and apparently they can't get at least one of the drugs that are required for that. So they're going to argue about, you know, that the application of it would be cruel and unusual, and therefore it's unconstitutional. They're also arguing that it's tremendously expensive. The special lethal injection chamber was built in California a number of years back, and that was over $1 million. In April, the New Hampshire Supreme Court upheld Addison's death sentence. They're now going to file with the U.S. Supreme Court, and it'll work its way through those appeals. But basically making an argument that the death penalty as it's administered in New Hampshire would be unconstitutional.
Well, and Gary, just remind us of the little history here. I mean, New Hampshire came close to repealing the death penalty. Gosh, was it a decade ago, Gary? 1999, maybe? The world was watching. We came very close when Jean Shaheen was governor.
Yeah, we did. And, I mean, we've come close several times since then, too. I mean, it's one of those issues that keeps coming back every once in a while. When Jean Shaheen was governor, she vowed to veto it, which sort of put the kibosh on it. But it certainly had at that point, it had the wheels to go. And I think people a couple of years ago thought that they had the votes necessary, and it deadlocked in the Senate 12-12. So it's close. It's been close. And, I mean, and Governor Maggie Hassan had said she would sign it, and that was what everybody was hoping, that, you know, we finally got a governor who will sign it.
Sign a repeal. Yeah.
And then it deadlocked in the Senate.
All right. Well, we will catch up on more of the latest news of the week around the Granite State in just a moment. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. We'd love to hear from you, your questions, comments, thoughts on some of the top stories that we're covering. So, gentlemen, let's turn to the presidential primary. And Paul Steinhauser, Gary alluded to this before, but I'd love to hear from you the latest rumblings on the presidential primary front and others wanting to get in on the goodies.
Yeah,
here.
this happened earlier in the week when Reince Priebus, he's the chairman of the Republican National Committee, in an interview with the National Journal suggested that maybe it's time to shake things up, not in the 2016 cycle, that's already set, but in the 2020 cycle. We've heard this in past cycles, too, that the carve-out states like New Hampshire, Iowa, South Carolina, and more recently Nevada should not be going first or not go first all the time. This has happened in cycles past. Others have raised it, especially people from other states. Now you've got a party chairman talking about it, which adds a little more weight to it. That set a lot of alarm bells up here in Manchester and in Concord and in Des Moines, obviously, and Columbia and Charleston, South Carolina. A lot of pushback. We've been through this before. We've seen this dance before, and we're going to have to deal with it again. But New Hampshire keeps coming out on top every time.
Well, and Paul, I'd love to ask you about your past experience. You used to work with CNN at the national level. How is this issue viewed when it comes up nationally? I mean, here in New Hampshire, we obviously have our own parochial mm-hmm. interest. But when national reporters hear about this, do they think, eh?
You know, it's funny. National reporters like the way the system is, and so do the campaigns right now. They're used to it. It's very easy. It's very convenient. New Hampshire and Iowa know, and South Carolina know how the voters here know how to do this very well. So you'll see pushback not only from the national media, but also from the presidential campaigns. It's basically coming from a lot of top fundraisers and a lot of the other states who feel left out and who say, listen, Iowa and New Hampshire are not ethnically diverse. They shouldn't be going first all the time.
Yeah, that's the old argument that we've heard many times before. Dean, why is Reince Priebus doing this?
The rumor is that there's sort of been pressure on him by some big Republican donors in other states who want in on the action. And, you know, for many years there have been these proposals of, rotating regional primaries or draw the states randomly by a lottery, shorten the schedule. I mean, the RNC and to some extent the DNC, although they're not involved in this particular iteration at the moment, have tried to kind of reassert control on the process. They have a sense that the process between the media and the individual states and the campaigns, the process has kind of gotten out of control. Too many debates, too much front loading of the schedule, et cetera, et cetera. So you know, he raised this. You know, it's not even clear how much longer he will be RNC chair. They may switch after the next convention. Here a lot of the pressure will be obviously Bill Gardner. We have that, our Secretary of State. We have that state law that says we have to be a week before any similar contest. He has stuck by that. I was trying to remember, though, if we actually get the primary this time on February 9th, I'm trying to remember the last time we actually had a February primary. It was probably 2004. Certainly 08 and 12 have been in January because
early
we
January.
Right after New Year.
So, you haven't even put away your Christmas tree yet.
Yeah, so he has already said that he's going to stick by that. And then the other individual, Steve Dupree, who is the state representative to the Republican National Committee, there's going to be a lot of kind of pressure for him in terms of how he deals with the RNC when it meets to discuss this. But, you know, this has been going on at least since the 1980s, and it'll continue, but New Hampshire's in reasonably good shape.
Well, what's interesting to me is, yes, we've talked about this a long time. Other states, as you guys both said, you know, want to get in on the action. Totally understandable. But Paul mentioned the big donors this time around, not happy with the four leadoff states. What's their problem with this? Paul, Gary?
Well, they put a lot of money. Listen, big donors have a big say in national politics, especially, you know, the chairman of the Republican Party, his job is to raise money. That's job number one. So when the donors say something, he listens. And, yeah, there are plenty of donors around the country who would like to see it differently, no doubt about it. But at the end of the day, we'll probably see New Hampshire, Iowa, South Carolina, and Nevada continue with their role. This is going to go through a couple of iterations. First, the Republican National Committee is going to deal with this in January, and then there'll be a final vote at the convention in July out in Cleveland. Stay tuned.
Again, for 2020, Paul.
This is 2016 is done. It's in the books.
Sure.
Not going to be changed.
Gary.
But the problem for, you know, for the Republicans and the Democrats is they don't control primaries and they don't control the caucuses. The states do. And they can impose all the sort of sanctions they want. But, I mean, the state, New Hampshire can do what New Hampshire wants because it's a state's primary. It's not the Republicans' primary. It's not the Democrats' primary. It's the state's primary. So as long as we have Bill Gardner there or whatever.
You mean Superman.
Superman. I mean, New Hampshire's going to be.
True, but the flip side to that is I think federal courts have ruled that the parties themselves actually get to control their party primary calendars. So it's a give and take here.
Well, it's interesting, again, because we've always talked about this. The push-pull, as you guys said, between the big parties and the states, and they have their own agendas and their own way of doing things. But now we have these big donors. So that's a third sort of element, Gary.
Oh, I mean, and the People's United decision has really given these people a huge amount of influence. I mean, they can just dump millions into these super PACs that are largely unregulated and they're really good. It's just so amazing how much money that's being poured into these campaigns.
Yeah, this is the first time, though, I've heard about them wanting to mess with the schedule, Dean.
Yeah, I mean, there's always pressure from kind of elites in the parties to sort of set the schedule in ways that will either favor their states or their region of the country or even their own kind of individual political ambitions. It is interesting, you know, as we talk about this, contest nationalizing. It does seem like there is a lot of kind of focus on retail politics in New Hampshire and Iowa. It's kind of sort of coming back in a way that we haven't seen in a while. Lots of candidates here doing things.
Sure. And coming up in a moment, we'll hear from some more of those candidates, Ben Carson, Donald Trump, and we'll talk about Joe Biden, what he might do. Stay with us. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup today in The Exchange. Let's hear from you as we cover some of the top New Hampshire news stories of the week. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-NHPR. Paul Steinhauser's here, political director and anchor for NH1 News, along with Gary Reno, statehouse reporter for the New Hampshire Union Leader in Sunday News, and Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. Again, you can join us with a phone call at 1-800-892-6477. Gentlemen, let's talk about Joe Biden. And Dean Spiliotis, you first. There's all this speculation about what Vice President Biden might do.
That's right. You know, there's this draft Biden movement that has been ramping up here in New Hampshire and around the country. It's ironic, you know, given the tragedy that he's been through in his family in recent months, he's probably better positioned to run now than he's been at any time in recent history. He's run for president before. He has not been a particularly compelling candidate, even though he ended up being President Obama's vice presidential pick. So kind of the reality of a Biden candidacy may be something different from kind of the buildup right now, but he's certainly enjoying a lot of buildup. He just got an endorsement recently with Marjorie Smith, who's a Democratic state rep from Durham, said if he gets in, she would support him. And so the draft Biden committee in the state has been touting that a little bit. You know, there is this Democratic debate coming up on October 13th. The sense is now that even though CNN, I think, or whoever is running it has essentially said you can announce on that day and we'll let you into the debate just because that would be great TV for them. You know, I think he's more likely going to be driven by the filing deadlines if he gets in. He'll probably skip this debate and have to make a decision by what, November 20th is the cutoff for filing here in New Hampshire. So
wow. So we're finally getting a Democratic debate, Dean.
Yes. It would be the first one October 13th. And so I think it's in Nevada. It's Las Vegas because it is in Nevada. Yeah. So it'll be interesting to finally see that.
So New Hampshire endorsement from Marjorie Smith, former chair of the House Finance Committee. So, you know, she had a big role when Democrats were in charge in the House. What are you hearing on the ground, Paul, about Joe Biden?
I've talked to a couple of people who are part of his political circle and, you know, they're talking background or and they're saying that he's pushing back. The deadline of when. Remember, originally it was going to be he was going to have a decision by the end of the summer. Well,
sure.
The end of the summer has already come and gone.
Yeah.
He is not going to this debate in Las Vegas. That's
so you know that,
CNN's
he's not
reporting
going.
That. CNN's reporting, and it's their debate, so they're reporting that he's not going to the debate. And now he feels like he could wait a little bit longer, maybe till the end of October, or as Dean said, you know, before those deadlines for filing start in early November. Thing is, though, that's fine. And maybe he's waiting to see if Hillary Clinton continues to deteriorate. Her poll numbers have dropped. But he's got to get in soon because you've got to start getting a structure in place. You've got to start raising money. This is not going to be a cheap campaign. If you're vice president, it costs a lot of money to fly around the country on Air Force Two. So the clock is definitely ticking here. He's taking all that into consideration as he also struggles with his family about whether he's ready to do this emotionally.
Well, an unspeakable loss, mm-hmm. of course, of his son. And I wonder what our listeners think of this. Again, you can join us 1-800-892-6477. Would you like to see Joe Biden jump in? 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, find us on Facebook or Twitter, 1-800-892-6477. Gary Reno talking about debates and Joe Biden not at this debate on October 13th. Only six Democratic debates, despite a lot of yelling by state Democrats. Give us more debates. We want to be like the Republicans.
Well, this coalition put out a statement yesterday of 60 people, independents and Democrats. Some pretty good, pretty big names, Peter Berling, a couple of state senators, some former senators, quite a few House members, a lot of activists like the Rouse, John Rouse.
John and Mary, yeah. Sure.
And anyway, they're saying, you know, this is just undemocratic and it's just not fair and it's just not what the New Hampshire primary is all about. We need debates. And if we stop and we think the last couple of times that we've had presidential primaries in the state of New Hampshire, we've had a lot of debates in New Hampshire. We've had three or four debates in New Hampshire the last three or four times.
20-plus nationally.
And 20-plus nationally.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, to limit it to six is quite a come down from. And, I mean, it's obviously it's an attempt to kind of limit the damage, but at what expense?
You know? And at this point, Republicans are, you know, making headlines. People are talking. People are saying, did you see Ted Cruz? Did you see Marco Rubio? And, you know, the Democrats aren't getting as much attention. So from that standpoint, Dean, you know, you kind of wonder.
That is a concern. And because certainly people are not talking about the Democratic field the way they are about the Republican field. I mean, part of that is just size. But I think part of it is also that there haven't been any debates yet. And then the timing of the debates with the one New Hampshire debate in December, that there's not going to be any debate between Iowa and New Hampshire is unusual. That's usually sort of a big pivotal moment. But it is part of this attempt by the party, or at least, well, I mean, and the Republicans have, they're down to, I think, nine. They were also up around 20 plus. So both parties view this sort of proliferation of debates as potentially damaging to the candidates or to the party brand, so to speak. So they've tried to clamp down on it. And I think, you know, maybe we don't need 20 debates, but, you know, six is just such a dramatic decrease from the last cycle.
Okay, so here in the Granite State, we like to be innovative. So, Paul, you've talked about this before, but just remind us, NH1 is trying to present the information without skirting the rules.
Well, yeah, we have announced a forum, not a debate, which the Democratic National Committee is encouraging right now. They're encouraging more forums. We've announced that that we're going to hold the Live Free or Die forum on February 3rd. That's 2 days after the Iowa caucuses and less than a week before the primary.
So what's the difference between
the difference
your forum
is they can't
debate?
Be on the stage at the same time. They can't interact with each other.
I see.
Now, if perchance the DNC changes their rules and Debbie Wasserman Schultz, the chair of the Democratic National Committee, is under pressure, even from some vice chairs in the DNC, to allow more debates or allow unsanctioned debates. If the rules do change, we would be very interested in, you know, changing our forum into a debate and adding partners. So anybody out there?
Stay tuned.
Stay tuned.
Stay
yes.
tuned. Well, and, you know, again, we've seen things shake out a lot after Iowa. So we'll set that aside for now. October 13th is the next debate. The exchange number for you to join the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup is 1-800-892-6477. We'd love to get your questions and comments in as we cover some of the top headlines around the Granite State. And Donald Trump was in the state, flipping back to the Republicans this week in the Keene area. Paul, you had an interview with Donald Trump as he arrived for a rally at the high school in Keene. Donald Trump's numbers, Paul, have been dipping a little bit, but he's still leading. Fill us in there, and then we'll hear
leading.
Some of the sound.
Still, definitely, Laura. He's still the front runner, no doubt about that. But his numbers are not where they were in the summer. So maybe the summer of Trump is over and he's starting to fade a little bit, but still the front runner. I had a chance to talk to him one-on-one as he arrived at the high school in Keene, asked him about his tax plan. Conservatives have criticized it, saying all these tax cuts for the lower and higher-end income people are going to balloon the deficit. He pushed back big time, saying, listen, I'm going to bring so many jobs back to this country. He talked about his business tax cuts, which will allow corporations to bring a lot of money from overseas back here, and that'll create job growth. So he said the deficit is not a problem. He took shots at Jeb Bush. He took shots at Marco Rubio. He took a shot at Rand Paul. And at the actual event where he had almost 3,000 people there, maybe a little bit more. It was pretty packed. He talked about Syria.
Okay. And we played some of that sound earlier, him saying, if I'm elected, Syrian refugees, you're going back, which was a reversal, right, Dean, of his
yeah,
earlier
he had
position.
Said earlier, I don't remember how far back it was, but in an early interview, he was asked about what was happening over there. And he said that, you know, on humanitarian grounds, you probably would have to let them in, even though he'd be concerned. And now in this most recent comments, he was talking about the possibility of a, you know, an ISIS army secretly coming in the guise of Syrian refugees. And it really sort of fed into the kind of the enthusiasm of the crowd for that approach on immigration.
All right. Well, let's hear what Donald Trump said this week again in your interview, Paul, when you asked him what he thought about Marco Rubio, who's rising in some polls recently.
I don't know. Look, he's fine. He cannot do the job. We need somebody that's going to take our business back from all these other countries that are ripping us. We need somebody that's tough and sharp and smart. And I don't see it over there, that I can tell you.
Okay, again, that's Donald Trump in the state this week, campaigning a lot. Let's go back to our listeners, gentlemen. And Claire's joining us from Hollis. Hi, Claire. Go ahead. You're on the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. So I could support Hillary Clinton, and I can support Joe Biden very easily. I will vote Democratic any way there is. But I was at the New Hampshire Democratic Convention
sure.
about a week ago, and I was very unhappy because Hillary Clinton was the first candidate that spoke. She took two or three times the amount of time that everybody else was allotted. And when she finished, instead of leaving the stage like everybody else did, she came down and did almost like a meet and greet. They took pictures. It took quite a bit of time. And I just felt as though she was being honored as if she was the celebrity. And she is a celebrity. However, I just felt it was very unfair, and I believe we need more debate because the other candidates are not getting any exposure.
Claire, let me ask you a question. You said you could support Hillary Clinton or Joe Biden. If
right?
Vice President Biden gets in, how are you going to choose?
Biden.
Really?
Sure. Yes.
And why is that?
Well, I believe that people vote by name recognition and feeling, and right now Hillary Clinton does not have the trust because of the emails, and I don't believe they're true, okay? But I don't think that most people are even going to follow it. All they keep on seeing is this baggage, and they're unhappy about it. And the people that I talk with tell me that if Biden goes in, it's going to be a very easy switch for them to go over.
What about Bernie Sanders, Claire? He's
I like him.
He's way up there in the polls, and Paul's going to tell us in a minute he's raising lots of money. What about him?
I love him, but I think what he says is there needs to be a revolution, needs to have practically millions of people come forward and support him with money and with voting. And I don't think that the people who he will help the most are actually your biggest block of voters, and that they don't come forward. They don't vote.
Okay. Claire, thank you very much for joining us. And I did want to ask you about the campaign cash, Paul Steinhauser. September 30th was another reporting deadline for presidential candidates. What did we learn?
We look at these numbers pretty closely. It's almost as interesting as poll numbers engaging a campaign and a candidate's strength. The more money, obviously, the more powerful the candidate and the campaign. So Hillary Clinton raised $28 million in the third quarter, which is July, August, and September. That's a big chunk of change. Guess what? Senator Sanders of Vermont, $26 million, only $2 million behind her. And this was almost all on the internet and small dollar donations. That was the big shocker. He kept pace with her. And also remember this, Hillary Clinton's campaign been spending a lot of money. It's a big Cadillac organization, lots of people. That takes money. And she's been going up with ads, a lot of them, here in New Hampshire as well. Bernie Sanders, a much smaller, leaner, meaner campaign, and he hasn't gone up with ads. So he's probably got a lot of cash on hand right now.
What do you think about Claire's comments and what Paul told
us? Yeah, some sharp analysis there by Claire. She's obviously following the Democratic race pretty closely. I had heard some of the complaining about the state party event that Clinton did speak for almost 45 minutes, and I've heard some complaints about, you know, the seating of Clinton supporters versus other supporters, et cetera. I think, you know, Claire is right. Part of that is just sort of the reality of her celebrity. You know, but as Paul just mentioned, Bernie Sanders, who spoke later in the day, is also doing quite
about 45
minutes. Yeah, he had a pretty long speech as well, right?
Too, yeah.
Right, and they sort of bookended the right to keep people at the convention with the two of them. The interesting thing about Sanders' money is it's a lot of small dollar donors, whereas you can only give $2,700. Hard cash to a campaign during a primary. So the thinking is that Clinton's has a lot of donors who have already maxed out with the $2,700, whereas with Bernie, if they're only giving 100 or 50 or 200, you can keep going back to those donors until they hit the $2,700 limit. So the thinking is he's going to be able to go back to the well for a lot more money over in the coming months, which will be very helpful to his campaign.
That's kind of what President Obama did too, right? The first time around, Dean, he raised a lot of money from small donors.
Yeah, there is this sort of, and even going back to Howard Dean in 2004, there is this sort of conventional wisdom that one way you show viability is to show that lots of people have bought into your campaign. So lots of small dollar donors shows you have strength in numbers, you're viable, and you can go back to the well for money. Now with this, or with the Citizens United and the super PACs, the flip side is this sort of outside influence of big dollar donors. But campaigns still like to show that a lot of people are buying in.
All right. So, gentlemen, lots of candidates in New Hampshire. As one of you said earlier, the death of retail politics has been greatly overstated. We're seeing a ton. Jeb Bush was in the state this week, gentlemen. And Gary, do you want to comment on that? Or Paul, were you there, Gary?
I wasn't, but I mean, one of the forums he had again was this opioid epidemic.
Right. Spent a lot of time there, didn't he?
A lot of time. And I had a good crowd and a very, very frank discussion among a lot of people, including a lot of Manchester officials, where Manchester has obviously been hit very hard by this heroin epidemic. And I mean, you know, it was very kind of dramatic. And the police, the fire chief, Berkish, told the mayor, Ted Gatzis, at the meeting, well, we had another overdose last night.
Right. Know? I did see that. Maybe even reported in your paper that as they were sitting there.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's
terrifying,
it
isn't
it? It was a great forum for Jeb Bush, because he, as Paul said, you know, he was talking about his experience and his child's experience. And it's what retail politics is all about.
Yeah. How's Jeb Bush doing in the state these days, Paul?
At that event, too, our chief political correspondent, Kevin Landergan, was at that one and also covered that as well. Jeb Bush, if you look at the polls, you're saying, what happened? He's at 7-8% here. He's at 7-8% nationally. This guy was the front runner. What happened? Don't write him off yet. The guy's got – you'll probably see a pretty decent third quarter fundraising numbers from him. His super PAC's got a lot of money. Jeb Bush keeps saying, I'm in it for the long haul. So and the long haul is going to be well into the spring. He's got a big organization. He's got a well-known name. And he hopes at the end of the day he's going to outlast a lot of these people. He thinks that Trump is going to go up and go down.
The summer of Trump.
The summer of Trump is over, and he thinks Trump is going to start fading. He doesn't think that eventually at the end of the day, everybody who's right now clamoring for the anti-politicians like a Trump, like a Carson, like a Fiorina, he thinks that's going to fade. And at the end of the day, when people start actually voting in February, they're going to be looking more for politicians. So, yeah, nobody's writing Jeb Bush off.
Yeah, well, we'll definitely talk about the unpoliticians in a moment. But, Dean, I can see you want to jump in on Jeb Bush.
Yeah, well, Jeb Bush and just the process more generally, I think Paul's right. There is a belief among some in the party that at some point the kind of non-elected, non-politically experienced candidates at the top will eventually kind of fade a little bit, and you will be left looking at one of these more tried and true establishment politicians like a Bush or a Kasich or even a Marco Rubio. I made that earlier comment about retail politics, and I have noticed this cycle that it really is back full tilt. I think the last couple cycles, you know, the thinking was that the candidates were kind of uncomfortable with social media and the immediacy of, you know, smartphones and being video and being taped, making gaffes, et cetera. They've kind of gotten over that now, and they start to sort of realize that they can use social media to kind of build their presence. And as a result, they've kind of come back full tilt in the state. A tremendous number of town halls and retail events like we haven't seen in several cycles. And I think they're now sort of comfortable with the new media environment.
Well, very heartening for us reporters who love to talk to these people. I do want to talk a little bit about Ben Carson. He was doing some retail politics in New Hampshire this week, spent a couple days. Here's Ben Carson in Exeter speaking at a retirement community and criticizing leaders of both parties who he feels are too focused on being what he calls politically correct. Let's hear.
They want women to believe that there's a war on them, and they want us to believe that there are racial wars, and they want us to believe that there are income wars and religious wars and age wars and every kind of war imaginable.
Again, that's Ben Carson campaigning a lot in the state this week. And Paul Steinhauser, I know you have to go, so I want to give you the last word there on Ben Carson and his pretty busy schedule in New Hampshire this week and some of the themes there.
Yeah, it was a busy schedule. And from that soundbite you just played, that's Ben Carson. You listen to him and it's like, wow, he doesn't sound at all like a candidate at all. He's just so subdued. He's quiet when you talk to him in person. You don't get the sense that this is a presidential candidate. But look at his poll numbers. I mean, he's number two right now in the Republican race here in New Hampshire and or definitely nationally. I'm not sure about here in New Hampshire. And his fundraising figures, he raised $20 million in the third quarter. There's something about this guy. He does not look at all like or sound like a normal presidential candidate, but maybe that's part of the attraction right now. The big question is, will it last? He's got a pretty small campaign structure. They're going to try to grow it a little bit here in New Hampshire and elsewhere. It's a fascinating story.
All right. Always good to talk to you, Paul. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much. Appreciate it.
That's Paul Steinhauser, political director and anchor for NH1 News. Coming up, we'll wrap up a couple more stories on our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Laura Kanoy. It's the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup, and let's hear from you as we cover some of the top headlines of the week. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Gary Reno, Dean Spiliotis, a couple other stories that we do need to wrap up. And Gary, one that caught my interest was a sting over the state's new hands-free cell phone, smartphone law on the Seacoast. What's going on there?
Well, the Summersworth police stationed these two guys at intersections holding these signs. When one looked homeless, the other one was, I think, was a repent or something like that at a stop sign or
one
a stop
sort of those light, the end is near
something type signs. Like that. And they were waiting, and people would pull up to the stop sign. And some people would pull out their iPhone or their smartphone and take a picture. And then down the road, they'd get pulled over and summons because they violated the state's hands-free law.
Wow.
And I think very few people understand that it also applies not only while you're driving, but when you're in your car and it's running, essentially. You cannot use your cell phone and with your hand. You can have it up to your ear or taking pictures or whatever. And they nailed quite a few people. And the police chief in Somersworth defended it, saying, well, we got this idea from a national police organization. And, of course, a lot of people were calling, saying, well, isn't it entrapment? You know, these people wouldn't necessarily be breaking the law unless you were doing it. So, no, this is not entrapment. We'll see.
Yeah, well, the argument was that the people standing on the side of the road are not forcing the people in the car to do something they wouldn't otherwise do. They take their phones regardless. It's interesting, you know, the police chief also said that, you know, when this law first went into effect, I think on July 1st, everybody was really well behaved and they thought, oh, this is actually going to help. And now everybody's reverted back to using their phones. I see it all the time. People are constantly on their phones. It's just sort of muscle memory. You just sort of automatically reach for it at a stoplight. They're doing these things all over the country in a lot of different ways to try to enforce it. And, you know, you get like $100 or $125 ticket if you get caught. They did a period where they were doing warnings, and now they're actually fining people. So you have to be careful.
Well, it's interesting, and I think one of the people interviewed in that story that Gary talked about said she didn't know that it applied while you were stopped. I sometimes wonder, Dean, since the state police were kind of out in front on this, if people don't realize that it also applies in town. I mean, you see the signs on the highway, don't do this, but in town,
it just seems like
there was so many people.
And there was I think, you know, we have speed limits. People still speed. I think there are a lot of people who are aware of what the rule is, and they sort of kind of size up how likely they are to get caught in a given situation and make a decision about whether or not to use it. There was so much education. We had a year's worth of educating about how this worked. So, yeah, probably some people don't understand, but I think a lot of people have just decided that they're going to use it in the same way that people decide when they are or are not going to speed.
Well, and state police, again, took the lead on it. But local police, Gary, have a lot of other things to worry about.
They do, but, I mean, it's just the police chief in Somersworth said this is all about safety and people's safety, and we would be amiss if we weren't trying to enforce this law.
Well, speaking of police, Dean, there was another update in the very difficult issue surrounding the release of police video. Last Friday, just after the news roundup, so we didn't cover it last week, authorities did release the video of the fatal shooting of Hagen S.D. Lennon of Canterbury by two New Hampshire police officers. Now, this redacted video was released following a lawsuit filed by several media outlets. The decision went against S.D. Lennon's family's desire to keep the video out of the public eye. Can you just fill us in on this, Dean? It's very difficult.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and this is a legal battle that's been going on for some time. It may potentially have implications for similar release of body camera footage and other officer-involved shootings around the country. So people have been watching it very closely. I'm not 100% sure, but I think some of the media outlets have continued to push for release of the full video. But what we essentially got was a redacted video in which you see up until the moment right before the shooting, and then you see afterwards as the individual is being loaded into an ambulance. I've watched the redacted video. Other than sort of the self-inflicted knife, when you see sort of a red splotch on the T-shirt of this individual, you don't see any shooting. Mm. It's sort of fairly actually kind of, you know, sort of your typical video camera footage. But the concern was it would be traumatic for the family, for his children. This has been a pretty hard-fought battle, but you can now watch the footage and judge for yourself whether or not it was a authorized shooting. I believe the officer or officers have been cleared by the Attorney General's office that this was a self-defense.
Well, and a couple years back, I remember, Gary, we did a program based on some fine reporting that the Concord Monitor did on sort of mental illness and the police and the topic of suicide by cop, I think. How they phrased it.
I mean, and this sort of looks that way.
Yeah.
I mean, it does, and it's been a bigger issue, I think, than it's gotten noticed for. I mean, it happens a lot. I mean, a lot of these situations are very similar like that.
Okay. Well, again, the number for you to join our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Gary, sorry, do you want to jump back in there?
I think this is kind of interesting because this is what we can look forward to. We have two bills that are being held in the legislature that are going to be coming up in January that would require state police in particular to wear body cameras. And so what we're seeing now, we may see a lot more of this whole issue of what's what's going to be right, to, what's subject to the right to know, what isn't. One of the bills would basically take the video camera or video off the right to know list. Another one would not. So it's certainly going to be an issue we're going to see a lot more of here in the next couple of years.
Okay, well, Friday New Hampshire News roundups of the future. So we'll definitely be talking about that again. And let's take another call, gentlemen. This is Jim in Manchester. Hi, Jim. You're on the Friday New Hampshire News roundup on The Exchange. Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning, all. My question has to do with the local mayoral election here in Manchester. The first mayoral debate was on last night between Alderman Joyce Craig and the incumbent mayor, Ted Gatzis. It was striking that Ted Gatzis seemed to be on the defense, and I'm wondering what the panel thinks about his likelihood of being re-elected for a fourth term. He did say last night, when questioned about the sort of lack of economic development in the city, et cetera, he went to the point of saying that he wasn't the executive director, that he was, you know, basically one vote and it was up to the board. I thought that was a kind of a very defensive and strange approach.
Well, Jim, thank you for calling in. And, you know, we should talk about this a little bit, guys, right? I mean, big mayoral race. We tend to forget because most places have elections, big elections every 2 years. But he's right, Gary. Yeah, there's a mayoral election in Manchester, that off-year election.
Well, it's not off-year for the city because there's
there you go.
2 years. I mean, it's a very hard-fought contest of both. I mean, it's supposedly nonpartisan elections in Manchester, but don't believe it. Both political parties have checked in here, the Republican Party for Mayor Gatzis and the Democrats for Joyce Craig. One thing you have to remember about Manchester is it does like to throw out its sitting mayors.
Although Ted Gatzis has been there for
he's going for his fourth term. But if you remember, one of the more popular mayors that Manchester had was Mayor Wazorek, and he went for his fifth term. He got ousted by Bob Baines. And this election is looking a little bit like that election in that there were two Democrats running, and as well against Gatzis, Joyce Craig and Pat Arnold. And Arnold is now backing Joyce. So we'll see what's happening. It's going to be very, very close for election, probably.
All right. Well, gentlemen, one story that we should finish up. The emu saga came to an end this week when a Townsend, Vermont resident traveled to Bow to see if the bird was indeed his Beatrice. We've talked about this wandering Bow emu a couple times here on The Exchange. But I want to let everybody know that The Exchange was on this story early on. We heard from a caller on September 18th. That he thought the emu was from a neighboring farm in Vermont. So here's a call that we got a couple weeks back from Earl in Newfane.
It's hard for me to believe that how they would ever get over to New Hampshire, but they were offering a reward for its capture, and we almost had it captured here. We had it in our garden, but she figured out how to get out of it. And she's very, very wily, very smart animal, and very,
very
difficult to capture. So
the Bow emu, Earl, is from Vermont.
Yes, it is.
Okay, you heard it here first on The Exchange, wrapping up the mystery of the Bow emu this week on the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. So just to finish up with you guys, there was one more story. This is a fun one, Dean Spiliotis, a new way to check out the quality of the fall foliage. What do we have?
Yeah, the state is launching a new leaf tracker. Mobile-friendly web application so that we can help tourists find their way here over an extended period of time. Because the question always is, you know, when are the leaves gonna peak so that people can peep at them? And there's, you know, there's sort of the temperature and the moisture. There are all these sorts of variables that go into.
You could really geek out on that if you wanted to, Dean.
Totally, absolutely. So, you know, this is big business. They're expecting something like 8.5 million people, going to spend about $1.3 billion. It's a big portion of our annual tourist haul. So there's a lot of incentive for the state to do this. It's helpful. And it also will provide, not surprisingly, helpful links for, you know, hotels and restaurants and other things of interest. It's a great way to generate tourist dollars.
Okay, so a new tool to ensure you get the most out of the state's foliage. Mm-hmm. Visit nh.gov Interactive Foliage Tracker, the hashtag NH Foliage. Although, Gary, with the dry summer, some people are saying the foliage isn't going to be as great this year.
It really doesn't look like it. I mean, some of the low-lying areas that you see, they're not as bright as they usually are. And it's been very late to change, too, because of the warm weather and so on. So it'll be interesting to see. I mean, I think it'll probably be one of those years where it just turns all at once and it'll be beautiful for about 3 days in the middle of the week, and then we'll have a rainstorm and take it all down for the weekend.
Yeah, I was going to say, right. Good thing that storm is heading off the coast, because sometimes you do get great foliage and then there's a big rainstorm and it's all gone, and you have to look on the ground if you want to see the foliage, which isn't nearly as satisfying. Well, gentlemen, a busy week coming up. Dean, what are you going to be following?
Lots of presidential action. By my count, something like just in the, between this Friday and next Friday, something like 11 candidates are going to be in the state, including you know, Hillary Clinton will be here, Carly Fiorina, John Kasich, as we mentioned earlier, Marco Rubio, Chris Christie, a number of others as well. Just a lot of action, as I mentioned. It really seems like we're having kind of a rejuvenation of the whole concept of retail politics in this new media environment. So going to be plenty busy following all these folks over the next week.
Okay, and Dean, just to do a little commercial for you here, you have this downtown series, Pints and Politics at the Barley House. Anybody coming in to drink a beer with you this week?
Possibly. You'll have to check my website or Twitter, at Dean Spiliotis, to find out. These things are very last minute.
Sure.
We do have Mike Huckabee coming in October 16th.
So
plan ahead for that.
All right. Great. Gary, how about you?
Well, things are a little slower at the State House than they
have
been.
Well, thank goodness. You deserve a break.
However, there's one thing that you kind of can't miss these days, and that's executive council meetings, because you have three people sitting there who are probably candidates for either U.S. Senate or governor in between Maggie Hassan, Chris Sununu, and Colin Van Alstyne.
Okay.
So the interaction is always interesting.
Very interesting. All right, gentlemen, thank you so much for being here. Really appreciate it. Have a great weekend.
Thanks, Laura.
Thank you, Laura.
Dean Spiliotis, Gary Reno. This is The Exchange on NHPR.